Hello and welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast, as truthful as resources permit. My name's Jimmy and I voted Leave in the EU referendum in 2016.
My name's Jazza and I can confirm, I know you've all been on tender hooks since I announced that the tab was open for me to apply for the European elections as a Change UK candidate. I did subsequently close that tab, don't you worry. Oh God, the temptation was very high, I tell you what though. But then realised that there were better people, probably more qualified than me. Although maybe not, as we'll talk about later on in this episode. But welcome to the Right Dishonourable podcast. We talk about politics, social issues and current events. What are we talking about this week, Jimmy?
Well, we haven't agreed on the running order.
See, I would have just run with you deciding the order. You don't need to tell them that we are poorly prepared. Every time you let the mask slip.
We're actually quite well prepared in that we do have three well-chosen topics for you, whereas sometimes we are scrabbling around a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah. Well, no, things have happened.
Things have happened. Events have taken place, yeah. Which we will be commenting on in an uninformed manner.
Right, so first of all, we're going to be talking about, speaking of European candidates, all of the EU election candidates for Parliament have been announced by all of the parties that are running. A lot of attention has been focused on Change UK candidates, on new parties essentially, and parties that have gone crazy. So new parties including Change UK and the Brexit Party. Change UK have announced some candidates including friend of the podcast, Nicholas Matzi, who...
You can hear him bitching about the Tories several podcasts ago.
Yeah.
If you scroll backwards on your feed.
Mm-hmm. He's an absolute babe. But alongside a bit of people like him, there are a load of ex-politicians. What's her name? Rachel... Johnson,
who is not, running. Who's not an ex-politician.
Who isn't an ex-politician.
An ex-magazine like, editor.
Yeah.
And sister of the famous Boris.
And of the Joe Johnson.
And of Joe Johnson.
Who's also a politician.
Who also exists.
Mm-hmm. And then we had the Brexit Party announce their candidates. Surprise, surprise, Nigel Farage is top of that list. They are now polling... are they still polling as kind of like winning the
I think
European
they were behind
elections?
Behind Labour, weren't they?
Yeah, they're like jostling for first place with Labour, which is great. And they have, as well as Nigel Farage, announced Anne Widdecombe, who you will know from being an MP who voted against every piece of pro-LGBT legislation that was ever put in front of her.
That's good.
Also, what's her name? The Rees-Mogg.
Oh, it's Anna...
Anna Mina...
Jacob Rees-Mogg's
sister. Posh name, Rees-Mogg. Jacob Rees-Mogg's sister, who's also running, who wore an awful lot of pink on the announcement day and looks a little bit like a vulva, which I thought was a really nice look.
Those were some pro-feminist points there. Forgets the name of the candidate.
Forgets the name of the candidate.
Then just describes what she's dressing, compares her to a vagina.
Yes.
You hit all of the marks there.
I'm a feminist. And then, oh, speaking of feminists, UKIP have gone absolutely doolally, haven't they? Another friend of the podcast, Carl Benjamin, aka Sargon of Akkad, is pretty high up on this election lists, right? And
he's in the North East, I think.
Yeah, he's.
I don't know what his
around...
connection is to the North East because he lives in Swindon, which is not in the North East.
Surprise, surprise! I wonder if he's going to purchase a property up there.
You'd hope so.
Of the money that they've raised, but. He's been going around kind of being quite sweary. He's wearing a suit, which is quite nice. And has been defending his comments about raping Jess Phillips. Is something that we talked about on our podcast
several years ago.
But look at us, we're clearly a launch pad now for MEP candidates.
Yeah, that is the hope. Mm-hmm. I think, although probably not for much longer, if, you know, assuming we do actually leave the EU. I feel we should probably introduce the other two topics before
I got really into
you
that.
You did, yeah.
We're secondly going to be talking about Extinction Rebellion, who are a group of climate change protesters who have, over the last couple of weeks, held a series of sit-ins and have been really disruptive, especially in London. Quite deliberately.
They've been blocking bridges.
A lot of them have gotten arrested. There was a pink boat. All of the good things. And we're going to be talking about their demands.
And also, presumably, Greta Thunberg.
Greta Thunberg.
Thunberg.
Yeah.
That's how you say it.
No. I don't know how you say it, but there is a special Swedish way of saying it. Okay. She's the 16-year-old who has now become like the voice piece of the generation.
Yeah, well, she started these school strikes. Mm, the school children striking from school, also known as playing truant in English, every so often on a Friday to protest the fact that us naughty adults are destroying the planet for them, for the future and going forward.
Yes, exactly.
And she turned up and all the politicians fawned over her.
I mean, she is very cute, isn't she?
She is. She has pigtails.
Mm-hmm. And big eyes.
Yes.
And is 16. Just to be clear. And then we're going to be talking about Roger Scruton and the fact that he's a journalist who's recently been sacked. This is one of the things Jimmy explained. Sorry. Philosopher. He's somebody who writes stuff.
He does write stuff. Mm-hmm. You could call him a thinker, although that's not always evidence of thought.
Are we also thinkers? We think sometimes. Thinkers?
He's like a professional thinker, though. He thinks things, writes them down, and then people pay them money.
We have a Patreon.
We do. We're more like professional shit talkers, though, rather than professional thinkers.
And he isn't. What happened with Roger Scruton?
So George Eaton of the New Statesman did an interview of him, which allegedly was arranged because he's head of this. Well, he was formerly chair of this housing commission that the government put together around beautiful buildings or beautiful houses specifically. Mm-hmm. And Roger Scruton is at least a self-recognised expert in aesthetics, so was, you know, seen as a particularly appropriate candidate for this. When he was appointed last year, people kicked off because he had said some dubious things about the gays. Obviously.
Are you allowed to say the gays? I'll give you permission just this once.
Okay.
Don't make a habit of it though, Jimmy.
About Hungarian Jews as well, about George Soros in connection with that.
George Soros, the Hungarian billionaire who funds a lot of kind of like... He's a Holocaust survivor and also is famous at the moment for kind of funding...
Well, he has
liberal causes across the world.
He has a university he backs in
Hungary.
In Hungary, which I have a feeling... No, I can't remember exactly. There's been quite a lot of controversy around that university because Viktor Orban, the president... president, has sort of been putting pressure on... Well, been putting pressure on liberal values throughout Hungary, but particularly around that university. I can't exactly remember the details of that story. Anyway... George Eaton did an interview with Scruton, and basically the write-up of that interview purely focused on his controversial comments, even though it was a long conversation. Mm-hmm. And
Viktor Orban is Prime Minister.
Prime Minister. And then George Eaton then summarised that article for the New Statesman in a series of tweets and sort of highlighting some of the more controversial things, or seemingly controversial things, that Scruton said. And then the government sacked Scruton four mm-hmm. hours later. Mm-hmm. And the argument, I mean, Douglas Murray of The Spectator, which is, you know, more in tune with Scruton's values, then somehow got a copy of the recording of this conversation. Talk about that later, because that is kind of weird. Mm-hmm. And basically said that Scruton was sort of misquoted or taken out of context in certain places. We'll discuss how fair or unfair that is, mm-hmm. and also whether the government...
We get to hear Jimmy talk about journalism.
Yes.
Ooh, it's his wheelhouse. We're going to... tell you more about our Patreon that I teased but seconds ago. And then we'll go into the episode. Thank you very much. See you on the other side of Das Music. Oh, it hasn't stopped yet. Okay. On the other side of Das Music. Hello, dear listener, it's Jazza here. This is just a quick reminder that we rely as a podcast on donations from listeners like you. We have a series of overheads, not just our time, but also buying up-to-date equipment. This mic is pretty old now, and also stuff like web hosting fees, which is more money than you would expect. We really appreciate the people that do choose to support us on Patreon, and you too can support us for just $1 an episode. And we'd really appreciate it if you thought that this was worth $1 an episode. We'd love it if you could choose to support us. But regardless, this show is always going to be free. And on that note, on with the show!
So, Chaz, how do you feel of about having played, almost played a part in Nick Matz's downfall.
Briefly, what you are alluding to, Jimmy, is Nick and I have had debates and conversations that always come from a place of love, to be very clear, where we've debated things that are sometimes controversial. Like, one of the examples is his dislike of Chuka Umunna, who is now his boss, I guess. We should
emphasise Nick Matsey is a Change UK candidate.
He's a Change UK candidate
who has been
now
on this podcast previously.
Yeah. He's gotten a little bit of heat because of conversations he's had specifically with me on Twitter, which is hilarious. But also, I still think he's a fantastic candidate because you can literally see his progression on those issues while he's over time. We've had conversations first about Chuka Umunna, which he's now kind of changed his mind on, and about gay men being able to get blood, which he's also changed his mind on. And so
it was that latter point that got him in a bit of trouble.
Yeah. I think it's quite funny, actually, that the equivalent of pub conversations that we've had but on Twitter are getting him in trouble. I also find it quite funny that there were two Change UK candidates who had to resign within 24 hours of being announced because of stuff that they had said on Twitter, despite the fact that the sign-up process or the application process, you had to provide your social media. So. I mean, to be fair, Change UK have had an impossible thing where they've had to fill a load of candidate lists.
Apparently, they outsource some of the vetting to an external company. The name of that company hasn't
been
revealed.
Well, that company didn't do very well, did it?
Well, they say that the company did actually catch three candidates who'd said some naughty things on social media and blocked them from... These are potential candidates and blocked them from actually standing. So I guess they caught some, but they failed to catch others.
Yeah. But that was going to be inevitable, right? And they have asked some people who've said stuff about homeless people from Romania or black women, for example. I don't know. I feel like if there's a parliamentary candidate using the word whore liberally on Twitter, then just search for the word whore. Like, you don't even need a piece of software to do that. But anyway.
A whore's a bit of a strange one, though. Do you know what I mean?
Do you think?
It's a bit antiquated.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, but when you consider the people who want to be politicians, maybe you should go for some of the antiquated terms.
I mean, I think the list of cranks that have signed up to, or attempted to sign up to become European parliamentary candidates does indicate how unseriously people take those elections in the UK. It's not as though there's no crazy people in Parliament or in the House of Commons or whatever, but you get it with local government elections as well. You get some weird and wonderful people who are able to stand, in some cases, certainly in the case of some local government elections, because so few people want to stand, they have to take what they can get, the local parties, that is.
And to be fair, Change UK have been quite... I mean, in the same way that a lot of other candidates are, Change UK have been when they found these people, they've asked them to resign. Whereas we have some people with unsavoury attitudes from, say, UKIP and Brexit, and the Brexit Party, continuing to run for office.
So let's talk about Carl Benjamin. You went into some detail in the introduction, but BuzzFeed seemed to have been running a lot of articles around him where they basically... So there was one where they went onto his Discord channel behind his campaign and they found some sub-forums where people were saying some openly white supremacist stuff there, or people were seemingly talking about killing MPs. One reservation I do have about that story is that the internet, I think particularly channels, Sargon of Akkad or Carl Benjamin's YouTube profile, attracts a lot of shitposters, i.e. people who are just posting crap and not necessarily meaning it. Anyone who's familiar with Carl Benjamin's material would know that he attracts some slightly dodgy followers who say some slightly questionable things. I don't know if that necessarily reflects badly on him as a candidate.
I think from slightly dodgy to the worst...
Yeah,
I think there's a clear spectrum, and it starts at slightly.
there must be some nice people watching Carl Benjamin's videos.
for research, perhaps?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I've seen some of his videos.
Have you enjoyed any of them, Jimmy?
I have enjoyed them, but sort of in an ironic way.
in a slightly insincere way.
I probably agree with some of his stances on free speech and that sort of thing.
Right.
You know, even if you really dislike someone's politics, it's unlikely you're going to disagree with them on everything.
Mm-hmm. So UKIP started off before they were had any of their candidates selected. They were polling around like between 15% and 20%, which would be a drop from the 28% of the votes that they got in the 2014
European elections. Yeah.
And they won that election. They were the largest party that the UK sent to Brussels. Mm. They are now, since those the releasing of these candidates and the very high profile kind of like media the media appearances that Carl Benjamin has had, where he's not only defended saying that he wouldn't rape Jess Phillips,
you should clarify that more. What he said was, "I wouldn't even rape Jess Phillips," i.e., say that she's so ugly that she's
irrapable. She's so ugly, I wouldn't even rape her.
Yeah.
He's such a classy man. I'm really glad that we had him on the podcast, Jimmy, all those years ago, by the way. And he's also defended the use of the N-word as well.
Yeah, I mean,
you have interesting thoughts about the use of the N-word, don't you, Jimmy?
So the BuzzFeed again, like, dredged up some audio recordings from various sources. One, like, just when Carl Benjamin's been on like YouTube live debates and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing, and I think some of them are from his videos as well. And one of them, he's having a debate. This is not necessarily made obvious from the context of from the video itself, but it's made obvious from the accompanying article. Is he's having a debate with a white supremacist mm-hmm. YouTuber, and he starts like calling them white niggers. And I think I don't defend his use of that phrase, but I think he's doing it to wind them up.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, he's using their own language against them. I don't think he should have done that because, you know, it's obviously still a repugnant word to use. But mm-hmm. I think that context has changed slightly his use of that word.
Mm-hmm.
And then in another, I can't remember where the ultimate source of this is. He just starts calling someone a faggot mm-hmm. or something.
Mm-hmm.
I know what it is. It's actually one of his YouTube videos, and he's actually making fun of a video, like a series of videos where people sort of urge other people not to use slurs like retard or faggot or, mm-hmm. or whatever. And then he Carl Benjamin says something along the lines of, it's not even because you're gay, you're just a faggot. Mm-hmm. So he's using the word faggot in sort of the non-homophobic sense, I guess. You know what I mean? He's looking at me, Jez is looking at me very skeptically, I think in response to the BuzzFeed investigation, which is perhaps a slightly...
They did some Googling.
Yeah, a slightly grander
It's not
term.
Hard. He's not tried to hide it.
No.
Although his Twitter account has now been suspended.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So
he's defended the use of these words as like freedom of speech.
Well, no. He's said, breaking news, controversial YouTuber uses controversial words.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of saying that what I just said is that he's being outlandish for the sake of it,
mm-hmm.
Almost like the Milo Yiannopoulos mm-hmm. school of thought.
Mm-hmm. And they are from like a similar part of the primordial soup. Like they're both people who got their initial bumps in audiences off the back of Gamergate.
Oh yeah, yeah, that is true actually.
It's nice to know that there's still 5% of the UK population that either aren't aware or don't care.
I imagine it's a lot higher than 5% who aren't aware of the controversy around Carl Benjamin.
Perhaps.
Most of the country do not know who Carl Benjamin is.
Although they have, they've dropped from like 15% to about 5% since the announcement of the candidates. As well as Carl Benjamin, they've also got Count Dankula.
Yes.
Who we've also covered on the podcast.
The Nazi pug guy.
The Nazi pug guy, who's also one of the great candidates for UKIP. Brexit are kind of surging. They're on about...
The Brexit Party.
The Brexit Party, sorry. This is so confusing. The Brexit Party have polled between kind of like 23 and 28% over the past few national polls.
So in some polls, they're actually top, aren't they?
Yeah, they've kind of been switching with first place between Labour, who are on kind of like a similar range of the share of the polling.
See, I actually think the fall of UKIP in the polls is far more to do with the launch of the Brexit Party than it is what Carl Benjamin has said or, you know,
been criticised for saying. Well, because UKIP was a single issue party really anyway, and then it was whenever they had a wider manifesto and they said that we're gonna cancel gay marriage and let you smoke in pubs again. Like, then people kind of, like, that was stuff that actually damaged them.
Yeah, well, I also think just Nigel Farage's personal brand is stronger than UKIP's brand. And I don't think it's helped the way that Gerard Batten, who's the current UKIP leader, has taken them since he took over, including, as you say, bringing on Carl Benjamin and Count Dankula.
The Count.
The Count, whose real name is Mark Meakin, I think, or something like that.
Sure.
And what is it? Paul Joseph Watson is also.
Oh yes, I completely forgot about him. The hot Nazi.
Who was previously the sexy Nazi.
The sexy Nazi, yeah.
So this is an attractive YouTuber who is also from the same primordial soup as Carl Benjamin. So he's, I think it's fair to call him alt-right. He's called himself alt-right.
Hasn't he distanced himself from the alt-right? Like he has, said, I'm not alt-right, but I'm part of the alt-right movement or something.
So he said he was alt-right, and he was like, oh, you know, all these mainstream commentators are scared of the alt-right. And then he did a U-turn on that months later, or even years later, perhaps, and said, I'm not part of the alt-right. Stop criticising me for being part of the alt-right.
It is very possible that UKIP aren't going to get any seats in this election and be completely replaced by Brexit. It does depend on how and where people are voting for them and what position they come in.
Yeah, so do you remember how the election system works in the for the European elections?
Yes, we're broken into regions, and I can't remember the name of the voting system, but
it's
basically
it's a list system, isn't it?
Yeah, yes, it's a list system. So you vote by party, which has its own kind of problems because independent candidates are very rarely going to get in on those things. But basically, whoever comes in first, you have the number of votes that they have, and if that is larger than the person who comes in second, that first party get another MEP, and then you half it again, and then you kind of like work your way down the list until you have the number of candidates that are going to represent each region. So for example, there's 10 in the southeast who are the largest region, and there are, I believe, 3 in the northeast.
So it's kind of, it's a proportional system, it's a proportional system. Divided into regions.
Divided into regions that favours heavily parties. Yeah. So, for example, Tommy Robinson, I believe, is running in the northwest.
For UKIP?
No, as an independent.
Okay.
Nobody's gone anywhere near him, which I'm like, well, good for you, UKIP. Well, you did draw the line somewhere.
Gerard Batten wanted to bring him on, but I don't think he was allowed.
Who is UKIP's leader, in case anybody...
Yes, I don't think he was allowed because UKIP's constitution, at least previously, explicitly forbade former BNP members from joining because they were worried about infiltration.
Oh, God. I wonder how that's going now. Probably one of the... So we have the Lib Dems, the Greens and Change UK, who are pretty much basically polling the same. They're on 10% or just under 10% each. There is a danger here because of the voting system that because it favours like the larger parties, there is a danger that only a handful of people are actually going to end up coming from those three parties who are the biggest, most clear pro-Remain parties. There's also the fact that so their votes combined come to about the same in polling as like the Brexit Party's share of the vote. But Brexit Party are going to be more...
The Brexit Party on its own, really.
Yeah.
It's 10-10-10. The Brexit Party is sort of pushing towards 30 at the top end of the polls.
So they are all on, like... So if you combined Lib Dem, Green and Change UK, why do you think that there hasn't been an alliance and a very clear Remain ticket? Because the Lib Dems have been clever and they're running as Lib Dems to stop Brexit or something like that. That's how they're going to appear on the ballot paper.
Really?
Yeah, which I think
that's interesting.
Yeah, interesting, but I think that they've very clearly needed to be an alliance, right? Of at least those three main parties, maybe also the SNP implied. who would have then been the largest kind of like alliance if you're trying to push people through to a singular...
I doubt the SNP ever would have signed up for something like that. But yeah, I think you're right. If you want to make the election a referendum on another referendum on Brexit, then it would have made more sense to run a Remain coalition. As to why they didn't. Change UK have a very similar platform to the Lib Dems, but they're worried about the toxic brand that Lib Dems currently have. I don't really know what the Green situation is, to be honest. Mm-hmm. They obviously have their own unique brand and, you know, their own culture or whatever. So, but I don't really know why they didn't throw their lot in together. It would have made sense.
But then this is also the problem. If we end up staying in the European Union, these parties are actually going to have to govern beyond just not wanting a Brexit. And actually, MEPs are not going to have a say at all in how we leave the European Union if we do leave, or whether or not we're going to get a second vote, for example. So I understand, because they're looking beyond stopping Brexit, you kind of do need to run on like individual platforms. You can't just run as a single issue party, which is why the Brexit party is different, because they are running on, like, literally, they leave the European Union and then they don't have to declare anything else. Whereas there are more nuanced positions on loads of like other stuff with, if you're deciding to carry on as members of the European Parliament.
That is true, but I think as far as most voters are concerned, they will not see that. They'll just see, you know, they'll either vote in terms of how they just see the party in a broader sense, or they'll see the Brexit party on the ballot paper and think, well, I still want Brexit, so I'll put that down. Mm. It's going to be a very... People are going to try and draw a lot of lessons from the outcome of this referendum, and I actually think it's going to be impossible to do that with any sense.
What we need is another referendum. Anyway.
I think we should discuss some of the other Brexit candidates, because other than Nigel Farage and Anne Widdecombe, there has been a slightly interesting development in that they've brought along some slightly more left-leaning or just different candidates from the usual Nigel Farage mantle. You have Claire Fox from Spiked, which is kind of a libertarian-y-ish publication. Sort of very pro-free speech, sort of very anti-nanny state behaviour and coercion, that sort of thing. I can't remember where Claire Fox is standing, but she's sort of approached the Brexit party from that angle. You also have Martin Daubney, who's actually a former editor of Loaded. And he, again, sort of approached it slightly more from a liberal side of things, I would think. He's not... maybe you would describe him as blue Labour a little bit as well, because he's from a working class background. I watched his candidacy speech, and that was very much the platform he pushed. And you also have, I think her name's Lucy Harris, who's the head of Leavers of Britain, formerly Leavers of London, which is sort of a general Leave campaigning group that sought to actually... I mean, her main thing is sort of pushing back against the idea that Leavers are all bigots, and that she was trying to put more of a positive spin on the Leave movement in general.
She's sharing a platform with Anne Widdecombe.
Well, yeah, you know.
I'm just saying.
But I think it's interesting, because you actually have, within the Brexit party, it could have just been a Nigel Farage reactionary vehicle, and I think because of those candidates, I'm not sure how much of this will fit to the general public.
Who is going to be paying attention to any of those candidates when they actually vote for the Brexit party? They just know that it's Nigel Farage, maybe Anne Widdecombe's, are there as candidates.
I'd probably agree with that, and I think, you know, Nigel Farage is still the most important candidate within the Brexit party, but... To the extent people do pay attention to these things, I do think that widens the Brexit party's platform.
So the Conservatives are going to do really badly. They're on like between 13 and like 18%. So they're polling consistently under 20, which would put them quite firmly in third position behind the Brexit party and Labour. Labour's election leaflet is going to be apparently scrapped and rewritten.
Okay. What did it say?
Because there were 100 Labour MPs and MEPs who said that they needed to have a commitment to a second referendum on the ballot paper for them to be able to clearly win this election.
That's interesting.
And that would be a very interesting thing, because then if you combine, they become one of the pro-second referendum, not necessarily pro-Remain, but pro-second referendum parties, alongside the Lib Dems, Greens and Change UK at the very least, and the SNP implied as well, who are going to get a handful of seats themselves. You would combine all of them, and that's over 50% of the vote going to parties that want there to be a second referendum.
Yeah, well, I think we discussed this a couple of weeks ago, the initial polling for the parties, and I think this was before the Brexit Party had actually... No, actually, the Brexit Party was included in this polling. It was something like two-thirds of the parties expected to win seats were actually pro-Remain parties in a broad sense. And then that included Labour, I think. And then the sorts of pro-Brexit parties, the Tories, UKIP and the Brexit Party, were at about a third. I think that was it, roughly. Maybe it's two-fifths and three-fifths or something. But yeah.
It is definitely more than that now. Like, the Brexit Party have just surged. And if the Brexit Party didn't exist, then we'd probably... I mean, I'm not sure where those votes would have gone. I think the Brexit Party is more of a game-changer than... ironically, Change UK.
I mean, the other thing I've heard actually is a lot of local Tory politicians have actually said, including sort of local Tory councillors, have actually said they will vote for the Brexit Party themselves because they're so disgusted with how Theresa May has handled Brexit. And you have to remember the Tory membership is far more Brexity than the Tory leadership.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Tory membership is basically UKIP, people who should be UKIP members.
Do you think?
100%. Of course it is. Because, like, the Conservatives have been trying... They've never been representative of their members. Their members have always been more right-wing. Mm. Or at least since John Major have always been more right-wing than the actual makeup of their membership.
Yeah.
But, whatever. So, we spoke briefly about the Green Party, and obviously the world is going to end. What have you kind of like been aware of? Because we're both based in London. To what extent have you been aware of the what are they called? Extinction Rebellion. The Extinction Rebellion protest.
I've not actually seen them myself, but
Me either. I felt cheated.
Other people have noticed them, like, you know. You'll sort of meet up with someone at the pub and they'll say, oh, I just came from, you know, Vauxhall or whatever, and they were, like, blocking the bridge or something. So to that extent, I think it has captured Londoners' attention and it has generated a lot of media coverage as well.
A lot of media. A lot of that media attention, though, has been very, not necessarily negative, but has been spun and interpreted as being quite negative, especially with the number of people who were arrested in that first week.
How many people were arrested?
I believe it was 300, which is the largest kind of like number of people arrested from a protest for a very, very long time in the UK.
A lot of them seem to be gluing themselves to things. That seems to
Yeah, is glue biodegradable?
It depends on the glue, I guess.
Yeah.
So some of them glued themselves to the London Stock Exchange. This was a couple of weeks back, but some of them actually glued themselves to Jeremy Corbyn's house.
Oh, God. The arrests surpassed 1,000 over 8 days. And that was like over a week ago. They're not trying to get arrested now, apparently.
They're not trying to get arrested.
Yeah, so that was the first week. In the second week, they were planning on making it very clear what their demands were. So the first week was disrupt... and get the media attention. The second week was here are our demands, and then they've rolled out Greta Thunberg as well.
Rolled her out.
Well, I mean, yeah.
It just seems to have been quite a well organised series of.
It's working. We're talking
like
about
campaigns.
It.
But it's not just been like one big blowout event. It's actually been like a rolling cycle. And there was the threat that they were going to try and shut down Heathrow, which nothing came of, but that was still a news event, and it still kept them in people's attention.
What do you think of their demands?
What are their demands?
Well, I'm glad you asked. So they, in the UK, so obviously this is like a global movement, but in the UK, their demands are tell the truth. Okay. So for the UK government to admit and to say that there is like a huge crisis, we're going through the sixth mass extinction of species on the planet. They want the UK to commit to being carbon neutral by 2025, which is almost definitely undoable in any kind of democracy,
okay.
but is interesting because that is parallel and the same commitment that California has made to being carbon neutral.
But the UK is already does already have carbon cutting targets, doesn't it?
Yes, it so does. But they say that it's not quick.
It's not fast enough.
And then thirdly, their third demand is for there to be a everything overlooked by a citizens' assembly rather than by politicians.
So I have read about that. Yeah, I don't think you should. It massively discredits the idea of a citizens' assembly when you form one, trying to get a particular outcome in mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole benefit of a citizens' assembly is that it's another consensus-establishing mechanism. It allows people to sort of pitch in. So you assemble a panel of maybe 100 citizens in much the same way you would assemble a jury. So it's done randomly. But it's done randomly, and then they also select the candidates to try and make it representative of society as a whole. But if you've already got... It seems like a contradiction in their movement. They already know what they want. So what's the point of actually... you know, getting all these citizens together. Presumably they feel if the average citizen was aware of all the facts, they would think exactly what they think, if you see what I mean.
What do you think of some of the criticism that they have had of the fact that this isn't the US, the demands in the UK are not the US, and actually quite a lot of the UK has, at least under Blair and Cameron, was one of the leaders, one of the world leaders when it came to climate change and commitments to reducing CO2 emissions. I believe it was Cameron who started like the international Environment Fund or the international like Carbon Neutral Fund or something along those lines, and we committed like $4 billion to that fund.
Well, this is partially related, but I was reading about the Commonwealth, which I think is about to reach its 70th anniversary. Mm-hmm. This is basically the former British Empire, and it's an association of mostly states that used to be part of the empire. And the Commonwealth is actually, as a forum, is more focused on climate change than you'd expect, because there are a lot of small islands that are basically
going to disappear.
Yeah, if nothing's done. And I assume that Britain does have a fairly significant role within that.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, beyond that, I don't really know. I believe everything you've just said, and Britain
is very kind of you.
Is doing something about climate change, but I've no idea whether it's enough. But that's a political question, ultimately. It's not really a scientific one.
What are your views of climate change in general? How do you think... Because it was really interesting. I was listening to the most recent Talking Politics episode, and there was a David King, who used to be kind of like an environment advisor to the Labour government, and has kind of like been floating around politics for a while. He was kind of one of the instrumental people who was able to control the outbreak of mad cow disease in the UK.
Okay. Yeah.
And one of the interesting conversations they had, David King would suggest that we don't necessarily need less liberty, but we do need to have more control from government. And I would say that that's probably like a little bit of a contradiction in terms there. I feel like in order for us to actually be able to combat climate change and to... like do something as extreme as refreeze the ice caps, which is stuff that people are suggesting, then you basically need authoritarianism. You need all of the stuff that is linked to that to be re-centralized and for it to be taken out of democracy, because it clearly doesn't work with democracy. Look at the US. And actually, you need to be looking at places like China, more authoritarian.
This is what David King was advocating.
Yes, I'm paraphrasing... And he definitely wouldn't say that he wants authoritarianism in order to combat climate change.
But that's your interpretation.
But that is my interpretation of what he said. And I would tend to agree with him. I think that what needs to be done when we look at kind of all of these demands of the protesters as well, what needs to be done is a radical kind of like, basically a Marshall Plan, but for the environment. And that isn't going to happen within democracies. And so if we want to keep our democracies, we essentially need to move towards mitigation rather than prevention and appreciate that there are going to be some countries that are going to disappear in the next 20, 30, 40 years, and that we're going to see mass migrations of people because of rising sea levels and because of desertification and stuff like that. And we need to be making those decisions and preparing for that now, rather than saying we need to keep the oil in the ground and refreeze the ice caps, because I don't think that that is going to happen.
Well, that's quite a lot to respond to.
Well, respond to whichever or nothing, if you like. You can just add a little bit of yourself.
I really don't know very much about the extent of the climate crisis. If it, you know, is it a crisis in the sense that if we continue on our current trajectory, what are the costs of that? I actually don't know the answer to that. But mm-hmm. Are you already persuaded that radical action does need to be taken?
Pretty much. I mean, if we want to reduce the impact of rising sea levels, then yes. And of increased CO2 in the atmosphere, yes.
See, it's...
And it needs to happen, like, yesterday, frankly.
See, a lot of the language that even the name Extinction Rebellion, is the language of this is black and white, this is absolute, whereas actually politics is about trade-offs, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Which is why they are going in so extreme. Because by making really extreme statements that I don't always agree with, I think the whole idea of, like, we only have one planet and the planet, we're killing the planet. Mm. No, we're not. The planet is going to be fine. It's the amount of species that are going to die and the amount of human beings that we're not going to be able to sustain because of, like, a huge amount of the places that we grow most of our calories, like rice paddy fields and stuff, will be salinated and underwater in extreme cases.
You know, how you respond to, you know, we still haven't really defined, I don't think me or you know enough about this to define what the nature of the crisis is, if you see what I mean. But whatever that is, how you respond to that is ultimately a political question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the question of...
100%. You know, and that's why I'm saying that's why Extinction Rebellion have gone so extreme, so that the Overton window is more likely to be closer to, like, their end than somewhere else.
So they want more radical solution. I mean, I know that Greta Thunberg, probably said her name wrong again, mm-hmm. Sort of talked about it in a very... classically green way, actually, mm-hmm, in that mm-hmm. we can't have unlimited economic growth on a planet with finite resources. And she sort of turned it into a critique of capitalism, mm-hmm. really. She even said when she gave her speech in Parliament, or I don't know if it was actually in Parliament, but it was to a group of MPs, she said that people have stolen our future effectively just to make profits for themselves, like a mm-hmm. small group of people have done that.
Yeah, and I think that that's broadly true, right?
I don't know, actually. But, I mean, there are some, you know, there are some fairly obvious companies you could name, your BPs, your Shells, which are... they're extracting oil and they're generating energy so that they can make money for themselves. But it's not as if consumers have had no involvement in that, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we still buy the petrol and we still buy the products that are a result of all that energy being...
Yeah, well, but because we've been convinced that everybody has a right to have a car.
Mm.
And that's kind of like, once again, just like the liberty and the freedom argument, that if we really want to tackle this, we need to realise that we're going to need to have less freedom, at least when it comes to... being able to, I mean, even like seeing Tom Harwood, I thought we were going to have a Tom Harwood free episode, but seeing like Tom Harwood go crazy on Twitter because he has to suck his iced coffee through a paper straw.
Those paper straws are terrible.
Yeah, legit. But it has also reduced like a really difficult piece of recycling that wasn't being recycled.
Also, some disabled people need plastic straws.
Yeah, and they don't need plastic straws. They can carry their own straws. You can have metal straws that you carry around.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
like there are so many.
They need non-paper straws.
That desire for convenience over the long-term implications of everybody having that desire to have like a slightly better straw or not carrying their own straw around is kind of like an example of
example. I was being a little bit facetious.
No, thank you. It's very kind of you to say. I'll put that on a t-shirt.
But, you know, ultimately, which group of elitists decides what happens then? It's not obvious.
Yeah, no, yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, this is the whole Brexit problem in a way.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I kind of understand this desire for, like, a citizens' assembly. But then a citizens' assembly itself is also going to be undecisive.
Not necessarily. I mean, I think the Irish experience with their citizens' assembly prior to the abortion referendum was very successful, from what I can tell, anyway. And yeah, it got to the outcome that the government wanted, ultimately. Mm-hmm. So, and it will have left some people unhappy. That was always going to happen by the nature of the debate. But if you convene a citizens' assembly, there's actually no guarantee that they'll come to the conclusion that Extinction Rebellion wants.
Or any conclusion.
Or, any, yeah, potentially any conclusion. But I don't... this is a broader point, I guess, but even though there are always going to be problems that elite groups, whether they be sort of universities or politicians or the civil service or whatever, there's always going to be things that they disagree with how the public feel about things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe they do it on good grounds. Maybe they feel that the public's misinformed or is acting against their interests, although we can have a long debate as to who gets to decide what people's interests are. I don't think at this point we can just chuck democracy out there. If you're going to have a more top-down, you know, a top-down form of government, you can't just throw away democracy. You need to navigate your way to that. And maybe citizens' assemblies would be one way of doing that.
Yeah, but it's too late to do that now, I think. The amount of time that it's going to take for us to come to some kind of consensus through democratic means, I think, which is why I think it, like, we have failed. Like, we're past that point of no return now, I'm pretty sure. And people are talking about, like, this... Now we're talking about the possibility of refreezing the ice caps, which is just fanciful. So I think that we need to accept that and move to mitigation and get as many of these countries that are going to be most severely affected by climate change to be as kind of like developed and ready to deal with this as possible, and accept that we're going to have to find new ways to feed everybody, and we're going to have to find new places for everybody to go once they've been displaced, because that's what's going to happen.
Okay, but who makes all those decisions ultimately?
Whoever is leader of the government of our beautiful Star Trek future. So, Jimmy, can you... describe to me this Roger Scruton thing. Again, who is he? Like, refresh our memories.
If you've forgotten who Roger Scruton is, despite the fact I explained it to you about half an hour ago, or 40 minutes ago, probably.
Set the scene again, just very briefly. It's all I'm asking.
Roger Scruton is I think he's a philosopher. You know, he writes philosophical books. People pay him money to do that. So as a job, he's a philosopher. He also has written a lot in the likes of The New Statesman. He was the former wine critic there. And also The Spectator. Yeah, he was.
Philosopher. Wine critic. He's just another one of these posh people who has just managed to get...
He has a portfolio career.
Great.
As people say. He does a bit of everything. Anyway, he was also, up until recently, the chair of the Building Better, Building Beautiful Housing Commission.
Ah, because as a philosopher and wine critic, he is also obviously an expert in architecture.
Well, he's written a lot about beautiful architecture.
So he has. But does he know very much about... Because I've read people who've written things... I've read stuff from people who've written things... who've written extensively about things but don't necessarily know anything about it.
I mean, that's very rude of you to bring up Paul Mason at this juncture of the podcast.
But where is the lie?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I can't vouch for his architectural expertise, but at the end of the day, you know, architecture is about visuals and about aesthetics and creating beautiful spaces. And
I'm not sure it actually necessarily is nowadays. Isn't it more about, like...
It's about political
like
statements.
Efficiency. Well, no, it's like about it can be beautiful, but it's also got to be kind of like efficient to make and sustainable.
My understanding is the architect comes along and draws this amazing building, and the civil engineer comes along and goes, that'll never fucking work, and then just pares it down so that you can actually make a workable building.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, you know, you can have blowhards as architects. Mm-hmm. It's the civil engineers you want to watch out for.
Yeah, okay.
But, I mean, he seemed vaguely qualified to, you know, run this housing commission. Whether or not the government should be that obsessed with building beautiful houses as opposed to just building some fucking houses.
Somebody made up a job that they wanted to give their friend, didn't they?
I don't think necessarily. But anyway, sorry.
Anyway, sorry, I'm just...
We've got a long, rambling discussion about who this guy is, which I guess is appropriate. But he was appointed the chair of this housing commission last year, I think it was around November time. And immediately people kicked off and said, but he's written all these reactionary things about homosexuals in particular, and he's...
It's always very strange when you say homosexuals.
Well,
I called you up.
I'm not allowed to say gays. What am I allowed to say? Gay people?
Let's stick with homosexuals. It's fine. I don't know what you're allowed to say anymore, Jimmy.
Are you not on that committee anymore?
I'm not, no. I'm not there deciding.
Anyway, he's also said things about Jewish Hungarians, as we said at the start of the podcast, and he's also said things about Islam, including in the most recent interview, I think he referred to them as tribes.
An
invasion or something.
Yeah, sure. He was doing kind of like the old like white imperialist shtick of civilizations and...
Yeah, I mean, he was contributing slightly to that Clash of Civilizations thesis around Islam and the West.
Yeah. So he was interviewed...
He was interviewed by George Eaton.
By George Eaton.
Who then apparently sort of, you know, arranged this interview to chat about, you know, Roger Scruton's books and also his role on the Housing Commission. And instead, in the write-up for it, just focused on all the controversial comments.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Douglas Murray, who's a Spectator journalist who has obtained a recording of the interview, George Eaton repeatedly tried to lead Scruton to saying controversial things. So he kept bringing up, you know, all of the different things he'd previously been criticised for saying, including Scruton's comment that homosexuality was not normal, which I think he wrote in The Telegraph. In 2007.
Which objectively isn't normal.
Well, that interestingly, George Eaton actually phrased his question that way. He's like, well, you know, officially it is true to say that homosexuality is not normal in the sense that it is rarer than being straight.
Yeah, yeah. He probably didn't mean it like that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually read something that Scruton wrote in 2000 for some obscure, what was described in The Independent as a right-wing journal. Actually, I think it was Pink News that described it as a right-wing journal, where he said that homosexuality was more dangerous than smoking to a person's health.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I think he may...
I mean, if you're allergic to fabulous...
I think it's fair to say that he's a bit homophobic, you know, based on what, you know, what he's read. So I guess the interesting question is, this was all true when he was appointed as housing commissioner, and it was pointed out to the government at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So why, after George Eaton teased this interview on Twitter and then posted a photo, teased it on Twitter, did the government then decide to fire Roger Scruton, given that we already knew that he roughly thought these things? I think in some instances, his comments around George Soros's activity in Hungary, I think, have been slightly unfairly phrased. And there was something else he said to George Eaton around... he sort of said that Chinese people are being turned into robots by their own governments because of the authoritarian leanings. But the way the quote was actually teased in the interview, but it made it sound as though he was just being racist towards Chinese people, where really he was criticising the government. So I think he's been unfairly maligned in certain instances, but his views around homosexuality do seem a little bit regrettable to be polite about it.
There is a particular part of this story that is interesting when it comes to kind of like the ethics of journalism, and that's the leaking of the tape to The Spectator.
Yeah.
Right? What questions does that bring up?
I don't know how they could have got hold of it unless George Eaton himself sent it to them, and he has no incentive to do so.
Mm-hmm. Do you reckon it may have been nicked?
I have no idea.
Mm.
I mean, it's possible, I suppose, that... This is, you could get a potentially libelous speculation, but somebody must have had access to it that sufficiently disapproved of what George Eaton had done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth saying that after Roger Scruton was fired, several hours after the interview was published online, George Eaton posted a photo of himself on Instagram swinging a bottle of champagne and saying something like, celebrating after getting right-wing, homophobic, racist Roger Scruton fired.
Mm-hmm.
Which made it seem as though he...
Not classy.
No, no, not playing it cool. It made it seem as though he'd gone out of his way just to, like, get this guy.
Is that a bad thing? This is something I don't quite get in terms of the criticism. Because as a journalist, I think that you should sometimes ask leading questions. I say as a non-journalist. And sometimes you do have a kind of like a goal in like a profile you're making of somebody.
I don't think it was... I mean, I think he... The way he wrote up some of the quotes was misleading. And I think that was poor. I mean, I suppose you could criticise him as a journalist in that actually he didn't really reveal anything we didn't already know. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it was actually a very boring piece or a unimportant piece. But it's weird the government decided to fire him now when it could have just as easily justified firing Roger Scruton after the offence archaeologist went to work when he was initially appointed housing commissioner.
Mm-hmm.
Chair of this housing commission, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's a journalistic problem there. And I do think that it is the job of journalists to find out about people who have public positions. As, you know, being chair of this housing commission was a public position, and it changed. That therefore does mean something about what Roger Scruton can and can't say and what he should and shouldn't say. I mean, interestingly, in the interview, he also criticised Theresa May and her handling of Brexit. Maybe it's possible that was actually one of the things that got him fired, but it hasn't really been emphasised in the decision. Because I remember that Andrew Adonis was like on some sort of transport quango and decided to resign because he was so disappointed with Theresa May's handling of Brexit or something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he should have been fired?
I don't think he should have ever had the job in the first place.
Why not?
He doesn't seem, from what I understand, he doesn't seem qualified to chair a commission on beautiful buildings. And he's also a bloody homophobe.
So let's lay aside the... Lay aside the qualification issue, because that is kind of a separate thing.
Cool.
The homophobia
thing. Homophobia thing. He isn't an elected official. He's being appointed to that position.
Yes.
Were the people of Tunbridge Wells to decide that homophobes should represent them in Parliament, I would have less issues with it. I'd have issues with the person's... kind of like ideas and their thoughts about people like me.
Yeah.
There's less that I can say about kind of like somebody's appropriateness of all, because that's democracy working. Whereas this guy has views about people that are so out of step with society and where we are and where we have chosen to be as a society that I think that does disqualify.
Are they that out of step though?
Yeah. I think so.
There must be. Do you not think there's like a quarter of the population that probably thinks something similar to what
But
he
he's
thinks?
Not a representative.
No, he isn't.
He's not representing people. And so you can't play that card. And therefore the government has to be careful about who it puts in this these positions. And I think he was the wrong person to put
in. I don't think
that
your
position.
Argument makes sense.
Why?
Because you say his views don't represent the views of the ordinary British person. I'm saying actually they probably do represent... Like his views on homosexuality say... there's probably, I don't know what the figure is, but there are probably, maybe 20-25% of the country who probably kind of uncomfortable about homosexuality.
It depends how you define uncomfortable and what you ask people.
I don't think that works as a hook, really, to hang your argument on.
The hook I'm hanging my argument on is, I think it's okay to criticise an individual's, personal views and to have somebody not qualified for that job if they haven't been selected to represent people. So, like, I think that his views on homosexuality and of certain ethnic minorities and of a great Jewish conspiracy in Hungary,
yeah.
I think that that should disqualify him from that job. He isn't like a Farage who has...
he's not really
certain views.
He's not really been selected to represent people. I suppose is the other major problem with your argument.
I don't think he's
not a representative in any sense.
No, I'm not. But I'm saying because he isn't a representative, his views are therefore like I don't think that he should be having any kind of like a public job at all with those kinds of views. And not having those kinds of consequences. And there's been this thing.
We've got to sort of the nub of the argument, which is. What views should disqualify somebody from being appointed to a public position such as the chair of a housing commission?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a judgment call, ultimately.
Yeah, and I think that this I agree. Yeah. And I think that he falls on the no side of the judgment call.
I probably wouldn't.
And probably, actually, the homosexual stuff, the gay stuff, it's probably the thing I have the least problem with in terms of what he's said in the past, especially about like a Jewish conspiracy and the way that he talks about Muslim people.
Some of his comments about Muslims, I think, are kind of dubious. I think, having read actually other bits and pieces of what he's written regarding the Hungarian Jews, that actually that bit has been very mischaracterized in how it's been reported.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, that's sort of arguing the weeds, really. I just don't, you know, let's say... I think he is a homophobe. I don't think that disqualifies him from, you know, sitting on a housing commission.
He is a homophobe who has talked about his homophobia in a public space, in a public sphere.
Yeah.
And is...
So if it was known that he was a homophobe, but he'd never written anything about it...
Yeah, I think it would be different.
Would that be different?
Well, yeah, because then we wouldn't know about it. We wouldn't have evidence.
But the government might know, so...
Yeah, and I don't think the government should be... But the thing is, there was so much clear evidence that he was homophobic and, like, and... What's the Jewish phobic?
Anti-Semitic. I don't think there is strong evidence that he's anti-Semitic.
He's partaking in a big anti-Semitic trope when talking about Soros, definitely.
I think this is my whole problem with criticism of Soros, is that it is legitimate to criticise, you know, rich men acting politically.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he's Jewish is neither here nor there. I do appreciate that some people who do criticise him do so on anti-Semitic grounds, but I don't think that renders all criticism of him anti-Semitic. You know, but we could be quite boring about that topic. Mm. I just don't think.
Do you think that there's a...
I think there is a line where you can't appoint someone to, like, a public position, like, if he was a neo-Nazi or something, you know.
That's a pretty far...
Well, I probably would leave it quite broad, because I actually think, you know, this is a free speech issue in as much as which views the government decides are acceptable or unacceptable to be publicly aired. It's not censorship in a direct way. I mean, no one's saying that Scruton should be sent to jail or anything like that. Mm. But it's an important factor in, you know, defining the parameters of public debate. And while I don't like some of the things he said, I do think he should be allowed to say them, and I don't think it should disbar him from, you know, from the Housing Commission.
Okay.
That's kind of my view. But
I disagree.
It is ultimately a judgment call at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think if the government felt this way, you know, if the government genuinely believes that, it should never have appointed him in the first place, because none of these views were that hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And it should...
Yeah, I don't think he should... I don't particularly care about, like, how hidden it was. It just makes it really clear that he shouldn't have gotten this job. If the
government is, you know, is taking the stance that his views are unacceptable and render him unfit for office, it should never have appointed him in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and it should have done the due diligence beforehand to actually, you know, to check. But I am a little bit uncomfortable about that sort of... I mean, I suppose you need to do some, but it does seem to me that the parameters... The things that you can and can't say that will disqualify you from public office do seem to be, you know... The things you can't say do seem to be being drawn quite wide, is my view.
Okay. I disagree. So... thank you for listening.
It's too wide. We need to draw it wider, even wider still.
Yes, exactly.
There need to be more things you can't say.
Yeah, I feel like just being... It should be more than neo-Nazi, less than personal views. But these are public views that he's had. Anyway, we need to wrap up because this is a very long podcast now.
Okay.
You can follow us on Twitter, at @RightDisHonor. You can follow me individually at @JazzaJohn.
You can follow me at JDE Nichols.
Tell him why he's wrong. Also, leave us a review. Say some nice words, couple of lines. Always really helps on whatever podcatcher you're using. We'd really appreciate it.
Has anyone reviewed us recently on iTunes?
I don't know. I haven't checked. Why would you ask? right. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye. Toodaloo.